Dr. Mark David Hall writes, quote, "Critics of Christian nationalism almost inevitably claim that its adherents believe that America was founded as a Christian nation. As the author of a book entitled, Did America Have a Christian Founding? A question that I answer with a resounding yes, I've often been accused of arguing this position." End quote. From Dr. Mark David Hall. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. We're going to talk with Dr. Hall right now about the whole idea of Christian founding versus Christian nationalism. And Dr. Hall, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
First of all, let's define the phrase Christian nationalism. It's beginning to show up in different places, and it's almost always in a very negative context or connotations.
Absolutely. One of my chief complaints about the phrase is it's often used in a very subjective manner, so that if Christians enter the public square and oppose abortion because of their Christian convictions, that's Christian nationalism. But if Christians enter the public square and oppose segregation because of their Christian convictions, that's laudable. And it's that subjectivity that I think is just used to tar far too many Christians and basically argue that we should not bring our faith into the public square.
Now, you noted in your an article you've got coming up soon on this, the claim that America was founded as a Christian nation can be problematic. If those making it mean that America was founded exclusively for Christians, it is simply false. On the other hand, if the claim is merely descriptive, that is, when America was founded, virtually all of its citizens and leaders would have identified themselves as Christians, it is true, but uninteresting, end quote.
Yeah, I think that's right. I understand some very good people argue that America was founded as a Christian nation. I don't like that formulation because it sounds as if America was founded by Christians and for Christians, and maybe non-Christians will be tolerated here. And I absolutely do not think that's the case. I think America's founders knew that they were creating a constitutional order that would be welcoming of a wide range of citizens, including non-Christians, and they absolutely insisted that religious liberty applies to everyone. It's not just something for Christians. And so what I argue in my book instead is I think it's better to say America had a Christian founding, by which I mean that America's founders drew deeply and carefully from their Christian convictions, from biblical ideas, when they created our constitutional republic.
Well, let's take one example of the religious freedom idea that you just mentioned. George Washington wrote a very famous letter to one of the earliest, I think it would be the oldest, perhaps, synagogues in America, the one in Newport, Rhode Island. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's just a beautiful letter. So there's only about 2,000 Jews in America at that time, so this is not a powerful constituency that he was reaching out to. This letter, the synagogue had written him a letter, basically congratulating him on becoming president. And he wrote back to this tiny religious minority where he said, I'm not quoting it exactly, but your listeners can look it up easily enough, it is now no longer that toleration is spoken of. Instead, all Americans have the natural right to worship God according to their religious convictions and to act upon those religious convictions wherever possible. Again, that's not a direct quote, but you can read the letter for yourself. You'll see, I think, that it's accurate. And so he was absolutely insisting that Jewish Americans, just like Catholic Americans, just like Baptist Americans, have the ability to act upon their religious convictions wherever possible.
What do you think the majority of the founders of America would have thought about the subject of faith in the public square?
Well, I think actually that most founders embraced a syllogism that went something like this. Religion is necessary for morality. Morality is necessary for a Republican government. And so a healthy religious environment, by which they all pretty much meant Christianity, is absolutely necessary if our constitutional form of government is going to work. Now, this did not mean that many of them thought we should have established churches, because they recognized what I think is the case. Established religions hurt true Christianity. And so they opposed getting rid of established churches simply so that religion, by which they meant Christianity, could flourish. On the other hand, they were completely comfortable with presidents issuing Thanksgiving Day proclamations, fast day proclamations, governors doing the same. There was no support for the sort of radical separation between church and state advocated by the Freedom From Religion Foundation and similar groups today.
What do you mean by established churches?
It was very common, and in fact, 9 of the 13 colonies had official established churches. So these oftentimes involved things like the government dictating how these churches are going to be governed. Think about that for a minute. Even if you're in the reddest of red states, do you want the government of your state dictating how a church would be governed? It oftentimes had to do with tax support, so all citizens would be taxed to support one particular denomination. And America's founders, I think, were almost universally come to the conclusion that this sort of arrangement is very bad for the church. It hurts true Christianity. Now, some of them moved in a slightly different direction. They said, okay, why don't we have multiple establishments? Why don't we tax people to support the churches they choose to attend? So if you're a Congregationalist, you'll be taxed to support the Congregationalist church. If you're an Anglican, you'll be taxed to support the Anglican church. I certainly think it's a better form of religious establishment because no one's being taxed to support a church they don't belong to. And yet, even there, the founders decided this is probably not the best direction to go. So by 1832, the last formally established church in America, which was in the state of Massachusetts, was ended.
Was the most common form, or denomination within Christianity, the most common church that was established, would that be the Anglican or would that be the Congregational? Or it would probably be one of those two, I would think, of those 9.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we sometimes overestimate the number of Anglicans because so many of the famous founders that we know, a Washington, a Jefferson, a Madison, for instance, are all Anglicans. In fact, in this era, only about 15% of Americans are Anglicans.
Oh.
50 to 75% are Calvinists. Now, these Calvinists are divided up into different denominations, primarily the Congregationalist denomination and the Presbyterian denomination. We also had French Huguenots, and many Baptists in this era were Calvinists, Reformed Baptists. And so, yeah, Calvinism is by far and away the dominant religious tradition. 98% of Americans are Protestants, 2% Roman Catholic, and then you have about 2,000 Jews. Now, I'm talking here about Americans of European descent. I'm not counting Native Americans or enslaved Americans in these counts.
Right, right. That makes sense. Okay, the First Amendment says this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The word establishment, in light of what you've been saying about the established churches, I'm sure there's a link there, right? Can you comment on that? What are they really saying in that first part of the First Amendment?
You know, there's been so much ink spilled over this for no good reason, because the First Amendment means what it says. We're not going to have established church at the national level. We aren't going to have a church of the United States of America. Now, it's still permissible under the First Amendment, as understood until the First Amendment was applied to the states through the 14th Amendment, which came many years later. States could choose to have an established church if they so desired, but at the national level, there's going to be no establishment. Let me just tell you a quick story to illustrate how this does not mean the separation of church and state. Literally one day after the first federal Congress came up with this language that became the First Amendment, Elias Boudinot, who later became president of the American Bible Society, he said, I'm going to paraphrase, he said, hey guys, things are going great. Why don't we ask President Washington to issue a Thanksgiving Day proclamation? Adonais Burke said, oh, we can't do that. That's a European practice. Roger Sherman, the old Puritan from Connecticut, said, no, 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 it's a biblical practice, so it's perfectly fine. The House agreed with Boudinot. The Senate agreed with the House. And George Washington issued his wonderfully theologically robust Thanksgiving Day proclamation of 1789. And keep in mind, the House did this one day after it approved the language that became the First Amendment. So it's crystal clear to me, I think, if you look at the original understanding of this document, the First Amendment was intended to prohibit a national church, but there's all sorts of other ways in which the state or the federal government, for that matter, can encourage religion.
Now, I'm a little confused about one thing. Did this, what you just described, did that occur in New York City, or did that occur in Philadelphia? I'm thinking maybe Philadelphia, but explain that if you would, because I'm just a little muddled in my thinking. I know Washington was certainly inaugurated April 30, 1789, in New York City, but soon thereafter they moved back to Philadelphia.
Yeah, no, that's basically right. So the first 2 years that Congress met, they met in New York City. And then they came up with a deal whereby they said, okay, we'll move down to Philadelphia for a decade until Washington, D.C. is ready for us. And so from 17, I'm not sure the exact date, but basically until 1800, after the first 2 years it met in New York City, Congress met in Philadelphia, and then in 1800 moved down to Washington, D.C., where it's remained ever since.
So all those things you were describing with Elios, Boudinot, that took place in, Mr. Boudinot, that took place in New York City. That's cool.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we know exactly what went on because there were reporters in the gallery. So everything I just said is drawn from contemporary newspaper articles that covered this debate.
How about hiring chaplains at taxpayers' expense? Did the founders do that for the Congress, for the military?
Sure, this is another great example. So the Continental and Confederation Congress had chaplains, which they didn't pay until the very last couple of years, where finally suggested, hey, maybe these guys should be paid. And Congress took a vote. James Madison, then serving the Confederation Congress, actually voted to pay these congressional chaplains. When the first federal Congress met under the U.S. Constitution, one of the very first things they decided to do was to appoint chaplains, one for the House and one for the Senate, and they decided to pay chaplains as well. And James Madison was involved in this as well. Just nobody thought that chaplains would be constitutionally inappropriate. James Madison, late in life after he left the presidency, tend to document where he did question the constitutionality of legislative chaplains. But when he was actually serving in Congress, both the Confederation Congress and the first federal Congress, he voiced no objection at that time.
So let me ask you a question. If somebody were to just describe some of the things that the founding fathers themselves did, the very men who gave us the First Amendment, would they or could they be, slandered as being quote unquote Christian nationalists? I mean, by today's criterion.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm writing a little article on Christian nationalism that will appear on the Standing for Freedom website. And one of the things that really troubles me is that it's used in a very pejorative way, I think a very inaccurate way. Let me give you a definition by two of its better students. So these are two social scientists, a fellow named Andrew Whitehead and Samuel Perry. They define Christian nationalism as an ideology that idealizes and advocates a fusion of civic life with a particular type of Christian identity and culture, and it includes assumptions of nativism, white supremacy, patriarchy, and so forth. Now, if that's what we mean by Christian nationalism, I think Orthodox Christians have to reject it, right? We should not properly conflate God and country, and then we certainly have all sorts of excellent Christian reasons to post-sexism and racism and this sort of thing.
Sure.
And yet, Whitehead and Perry go on to say that 52% of Americans are these sorts of evil Christian nationalists. And it's just a ridiculous finding, I think. And I think they're good social scientists that are making a good faith effort. But when you dig into their sort of charges, it becomes very hard to substantiate. And these are two of the better critics of Christian nationalism. Wow. Most of the critics are folks like Andrew Seidel from the Freedom from Religion Foundation, who just write polemics that are just simply false. It's a concept used to tar Christians who believe we have an obligation to bring our faith into the public square in appropriate ways, opposing racism, opposing slavery, opposing abortion, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who did so much in a corrective way towards American racism and so forth, but he did it out of his pulpit, his Christian pulpit.
Oh, absolutely. And the entire civil rights movement, right? The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Andrew Young, and on you go, right? The leadership were Christian ministers who were oftentimes preaching against the evils of segregation from their pulpits, but then also leading a very public movement. And many white Christians, of course, joined this movement. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we have to admit that there were some Christians who made biblical and even theological arguments in favor of slavery first and then later in favor of Jim Crow legislation. And this is unfortunate. And those Christians needed to be corrected, and I think, fortunately, most of them have been corrected. So you do have people running around saying racist things in the name of Christianity today. I understand that's the case. But I think it's a handful of people, not 52% of the American population.
Dr. Hall, thanks so much for being with us. Do you have a website we can read your works and so forth?
Yeah, my wife put together a nice little website, markdavidhall.org, and it has information about my recent book, and then I'll have information about my forthcoming book as well.
Okay, thank you so much for being with us. All the best.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Goodbye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.